Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
A lot of people are questioning what this is actually going to look like. We've seen in the past with policies like stop and frisk, Black and Latino New Yorkers are disproportionately stopped and searched.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please. And watch out for the troops, too.
Thursday, March 7th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, Houthi rebels have been lobbing missiles at ships in the Gulf of Aden for months in retaliation for Israel's war in Gaza. And this week, for the first time, the Houthi attacks were fatal. Where that part of the conflict goes from here. Also, we'll hear about a new book that takes a deep dive into the history of the Oscars.
The greatest tale of sibling rivalry
ever.
In Hollywood history.
Yeah.
Maybe ever, I don't know. There's Cain and Abel, but then after that, there's Olivia de Havilland and Joan Fontaine.
That's coming up in about 15 minutes. But first, people riding the subway in New York are seeing National Guard troops deployed at some of the busiest stations, doing things like checking bags. Crime in New York is actually down since the pandemic. So is this move about public safety or public perceptions and politics? Gwen Hogan writes for The City newspaper in New York. She spoke to Robin Young.
Well, let's take the incident people might remember a while back of the migrant attack on officers. Republicans have wanted to link migrants with crime, but what is the truth about the crime rate?
Well, major crimes are down 2%. Murders are down 18% so far this year. Shootings are also down. Obviously, there have been several high-profile incidents, like the incident that you're referencing, where a group of migrants attacked two police officers. There was a shooting in Times Square of a tourist who was also the person that was arrested. The suspect ended up living at a migrant shelter. And city officials have said that the chief of police described this as a migrant crime wave at a press conference. But when pressed to provide data about this, New York City doesn't actually track crimes by national origin. So it's very difficult to actually determine whether that is the case. While we do see these high-profile incidents that then get picked up by big national news outlets.
Well, we should say people are looking at the fact that New York is a sanctuary city. This means a range of things, including police can't give information to ICE officials that would lead to deportations. We're going to get to more of that. But it's also a shelter city, which is supposed to guarantee a bed to anyone who needs one. You say that's now functionally ended. What's going on?
Well, that has functionally ended for adult migrants who arrive in the system and run out an initial 30 days in shelter. All those people that don't have any place to go after 30 days are sent to a site that's called a reticketing site, where there's now a waiting list of around 3,500 people waiting for a bed. That was taking up to 2 weeks several weeks ago. My understanding is now it's down a little bit to around 7 days, but it's still 7 days where you are sent to an overnight waiting room where you can sleep on the ground. There are no blankets, in hopes that you might secure another cot.
Wow. And then there's the city's sanctuary policies. Mayor Eric Adams has recently said, you know, they need to change. And as we just said, they usually mean that NYPD can't help ICE deport people. But does sanctuary also protect migrants who have committed crimes? Are people asking more questions after, for instance, the migrants who beat an officer were allowed to leave a courtroom? Their lawyers say they didn't flee, but people think they did. So kind of what's going on there?
I think what immigration advocates would say about this situation is that the sanctuary protections enable a level of due process for immigrants in New York City. And I think one really good example is somebody that was initially arrested after the Times Square incident. The DA has since come out and said that that person was not there at the time of the incident. That person was wrongfully arrested and is no longer facing prosecution in that case. Without the city's sanctuary protections, that person could have immediately be turned over to ICE before they were convicted of any crime at all. And so I think advocates would say that would have been a miscarriage of justice. That person needed, or, you know, that person deserved due process of the legal system before they were automatically determined to be guilty and worthy of deportation.
Yeah. Well, as usual, it's more complicated than it is, you know, just on the surface. So how would Mayor Adams make changes, has he said?
His administration has indicated that they want to roll back two provisions of the city sanctuary law, which were passed under former Mayor Bill de Blasio. They prevent city agencies from coordinating with ICE on immigration enforcement actions. And then the other thing that has become a contention is they stop the NYPD and the Corrections Department from honoring ICE's request to hold people in their detention unless there's a judicial warrant and the person was convicted of some serious crime. Yeah. However, it's a law, and the city council is further to the left of Mayor Eric Adams, and they have indicated leadership at the council that they have no intention to roll back those laws. And, you know, their leadership in the council have said these were passed as public safety provisions to give immigrants in New York to free them from fear that if they go to the hospital or try to report a crime or want to testify or they were a witness to a crime, that they would not be afraid of interacting with city agencies for fear that they would be turned over to ICE.
Right. And Gwen Hogan, just one quick question. How are New Yorkers feeling about National Guardsmen on their subway trains?
There's been an array of reaction. And a lot of people are questioning, you know, what this is actually going to look like. We've seen in the past that with policies like stop and frisk, Black and Latino New Yorkers are disproportionately stopped and searched. And so I think they're real constitutional questions as we see this policy put into place.
Gwen Hogan of the City Newspaper in New York, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, Houthis have been attacking cargo ships in one of the world's busiest shipping lanes for months, launching drones and missiles in a campaign that they say is in support of the oppressed Palestinian people. This week, for the first time, those attacks killed at least three sailors. Robin has more after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why Betterment believes cash can be a strategic choice.
There are times when the market is volatile, when customers are a little nervous about investing. We came to understand that there was an opportunity to introduce cash as part of an investing strategy and to give back yields to the customer.
Learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank.
At least three people are dead after that Houthi missile strike targeted a ship in the Gulf of Aden yesterday. These are the first known deaths after months of attacks by the Iranian-backed Houthis on the shipping route that connects Europe and Asia. And the Yemeni rebel group says they'll only stop when, as they say, the siege on the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip is lifted. NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam is here. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Robin.
And we know a military spokesperson for the Houthis said it targeted the ship because it was American. Now, the owners denied that. The ship was Barbados flagged with ownership by a Liberian registered company. But these ships are usually owned by investors from different countries. So what more do we know?
Well, yeah, it does get complicated, you know, once these vessels get on the water. But just to back up a bit, this ship was called the True Confidence, and it was a bulk carrier, which a lot of these ships going through the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, you know, there's a lot also with the oil tankers. This one was carrying steel and trucks and the like, and they don't have large crews. This one had about 20 people, and the ship is now abandoned. You're right. You know, ships like this, they're flagged by one country, owned by, you know, another nation, but is also who operates them. In this case, it was a Greek company, which makes it more complicated for insurance purposes and the like. Mm. The crews on board also come from a variety of countries, and often they're from developing nations. And in this case, the three crew members who were killed on the True Confidence were Filipino and Vietnamese. So, you know, even though the Houthis may think they're attacking a ship from a, you know, a certain country, in this instance, probably America, you know, it's actually any of these attacks involve many, many nations.
Yeah, well, three dead crew members. I mean, you know, the Houthis don't attack every ship, but this is obviously a problem. And it's sending ships on a much longer route to avoid attacks. So how do the Houthis choose the ships and what's their strategy?
Well, you know, initially the Houthis said they were launching these attacks when they started in November, that they were protesting the war in Gaza. They were against Israel's aggression against Palestinians in Gaza. And so they said they were targeting vessels with any connection to Israel. But in fact, Robin, many of the ships they had no connection to Israel. In fact, at least one of the vessels they attacked was an aid ship heading towards Houthi-controlled area in Yemen. And I have to say, there's at least two American ships that have been hit as well. You know, but now the Houthis have switched gears, and they say that their attacks on these vessels are in response to the U.S.-led coalition that's shooting down the militants' drones and missiles. Whatever their reasoning, the attacks are a serious concern, obviously threatening lives, global supply chains, and environmental concerns as well. Last week, a ship that they hit was carrying fertilizer. It sank, and now this whole ecosystem in the region is now at risk.
And just briefly, is there a sense this latest, you know, the deaths will lead to an escalation from the U.S.?
It could. You know, State Department Miller was a bit evasive on that. They said they were going to hold the Houthis accountable. Yes, they can keep trying to launch more attacks on the Houthis. It's had limited success. They've also launched imposed sanctions on some shipping companies and that are back to the Houthis. We'll just have to see if that's going to have any impact on what they're doing.
NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam. Jackie, thanks as always.
Thanks very much, Robin.
Coming up, Robin chats with the author of Oscar Wars, a history of Hollywood in gold, sweat, and tears, which explores the behind-the-scenes drama of Hollywood's biggest award show and the Academy that created it. Glitz, glamour, and grudge matches when we return.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why Betterment believes cash can be a strategic choice.
There are times when the market is volatile, when customers are a little nervous about investing. We came to understand that there was an opportunity to introduce cash as part of an investing strategy and to give back yields to the customer.
Learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
This message comes from Charles Schwab. When it comes to managing your wealth, Schwab gives you more choices, like full-service wealth management and advice when you need it. You can also invest on your own and trade on thinkorswim. Visit schwab.com to learn more.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
The Academy Awards are this Sunday. History might be made. Lily Gladstone is up for an Oscar for Best Actress for her performance in Killers of the Flower Moon. If she wins, she'll be the first Native American woman to do so. But as New Yorker writer Michael Shulman wrote in his 2023 book, Oscar Wars, the Academy Awards has had a scandalous history. The first black woman to win an Oscar, Hattie McDaniel, Mammy in Gone with the Wind, was seated at a segregated table when she won in 1940. There's also the vicious feud between sisters Joan Fontaine and Olivia de Havilland. Rob Lowe dancing and singing with Snow White in 1989 to the tune of Proud Mary.
Lead lights keep on burning, candles keep on turning.
Worst Oscars ever? Discuss. Michael Shulman does in his terrifically comprehensive book, Oscar Wars, now out in paperback. And we welcome Michael Shulman to our studios. Happy almost Oscars.
Yeah, the time is now. It's upon us.
It's your
time. I'm ready with my tux.
But let's go back, as you do, to the beginning. The Academy of Arts and Sciences was the brainchild of Louis B. Mayer, a vile person by all of your accounts. He was called the devil incarnate, not just evil, but the most evil man, untalented, mean, vicious, and vindictive.
I almost feel compelled to defend him now that you read all the meanest quotes. The Academy was intended in part to kind of preempt having the actors, writers, and directors unionize. In its first decade or so, it was very involved in labor disputes and contract negotiations. And because of that, the Academy was so hated among the rank and file in Hollywood that people would boycott it. You know, they would boycott the Oscars. What they did eventually by the end of the 30s was the president of the Academy was Frank Capra, the great director. He loved the Academy Awards. He loved the Academy. And he thought, if everyone's so angry at us for getting involved in labor stuff, we're just not going to do that stuff anymore. And he shed those responsibilities. And instead, the Academy really became the place that gives out the Oscars, which was the one thing that they had created that everyone really loved, because everyone loves winning awards.
Joan Fontaine makes her first appearance in your book just after the bombing of Pearl Harbor because FBI agents have knocked at this actress's door because she and her sister, Olivia de Havilland, were both born in Tokyo. And it was thought that they were Japanese-born. They were not. They were just born there. But then you go on to tell us about this feud between these two sisters.
It's the greatest tale of sibling rivalry in
ever.
Hollywood history.
Yeah.
Maybe ever. I don't know. There's Cain and Abel, but then after that, there's Olivia de Havilland and Joan Fontaine. They were just like oil and water, and they were competitive about everything. Olivia became a movie star, so Joan became a movie star. They fought over men. They sort of competed over who would get married first, and that became who would win an Oscar first. So Olivia was actually nominated first. She famously played Melanie in Gone with the Wind. She was nominated for Best Supporting Actress and lost. Then the next year, Joan was nominated for Hitchcock's Rebecca. She lost. And then 1942, they were nominated at the same time in Best Actress, and it was the Battle of the Sisters. And Joan won for Hitchcock's Suspicion. And she writes in her memoir, No Bed of Roses, that the moment she won, she stood up and she saw Olivia like clasping her hand and looking up at her, and all of the animus from their years and years of hatred and loathing for each other just kind of jumped to the surface.
They made no bones about it. It's just remarkable. Yeah. Just one of the many stories you tell. Another is such an important story in American history, not just film history, which is one of the biggest scandals in Hollywood, the Joe McCarthy congressional hearings that led to the blacklisting of Hollywood screenwriters thought to be communists. Now, many people know Dalton Trumbo was one of the victims of this. He and other blacklisted screenwriters scrambled to this black market and wrote under fictional names.
1957, Deborah Carr of The King and I came out and presented the award for Best Motion Picture Story to someone named Robert Rich, who had written the story for a movie called The Brave One about a Mexican boy and his pet bull. Robert Rich was not there. Robert Rich could not be located after the awards were over. Robert Rich did not exist. He was imaginary. He was a front for Dalton Trumbo. And so Dalton Trumbo spent the next, like, 2 years sort of playing with the press and using the fact that he had secretly won this Oscar to try to turn the tables against the forces that had blacklisted him. And this actually pushed the Academy to rescind its rule against blacklisted people being eligible for the Oscars. And then, you know, he finally got off the blacklist in 1960 when he was credited for both Exodus and then Spartacus.
Spartacus, with Kirk Douglas as Spartacus, the leader of the slaves of the Romans. You remind us, Trumbo wrote a scene in which the Roman general tells the slaves they will live if they tell him who is Spartacus. Here's their response.
I'm Spartacus.
You write this collective heroism reflected those who protected Trumbo, you know, the blacklisted screenwriter.
Oh, yeah. When I rewatched Spartacus as I was researching the blacklist and the screenwriters who specifically wrote Academy Award-winning screenplays while they were on the blacklist, that scene just jumped out at me in a whole new way. Mm-hmm. That famous I Am Spartacus scene, it's about the power of the pseudonym. It's about if everyone is Spartacus, then no one is Spartacus. And you can sort of retain the anonymity and not give him up. And I just got chills when I watched the movie again and realized that this was, in a way, a kind of blacklist metaphor.
It's really quite something. Another thing that's very powerful is the experience of black Oscar winners. Hattie McDaniel, Sidney Poitier, Halle Berry, all winners, and you write, all found themselves representing everyone and pleasing no one.
Yeah, I mean, I had a chapter where I wove those three stories together, which happened across decades, you know. Hattie McDaniel won in 1940, Best Supporting Actress for Gone with the Wind, and then it wasn't until 1964 that Poitier won Best Actor, and then it wasn't until 2002 that Halle Berry became the first black woman to win in Best Actress. These are moments that we all remember as being very inspiring. They give very emotional, inspiring speeches. And they're celebratory. And yet, as I look closer at those three individual stories and how their careers and lives unfolded, they were all very isolated. And they all had this burden of, you know, representing an entire race of people who had not been let into the Academy Awards.
I want to, you know, bring us up to today. Lily Gladstone is the front runner for her role as an Osage woman whose family is dying all around her in Killers of the Flower Moon. She would be the first Native American woman to win Best Actress.
Yeah, she would.
And it sounds like there might be a cautionary tale in that, you know, that it's a hard mantle to carry.
Yeah, in fact, I interviewed Lily Gladstone for The New Yorker a couple weeks ago. And having looked so closely at these past winners, like a story that jumped to mind was right after Sidney Poitier won in 1964, he was honored at the mayor of New York City's office, and he gave a press conference, and all the reporters kept asking him about civil rights. And he said, "Why are you asking me about my Negroness?" He said, "Why don't you ask me any human questions? Why don't you ask me about acting?" And I sort of thought about this. Well, I don't want to fall into that trap and just sort of have Lily Gladstone be, you know, a spokeswoman for Native American issues. She's very happy to talk about them, especially a language revitalization she's very passionate about. But I also was like, okay, you're an actress. You know, Emma Stone doesn't have to go around talking about, you know, her culture as she campaigns for Best Actress. So let's talk about acting with Lily Gladstone, too, because she's an incredible actress.
Well, again, staying with today's Oscars, maybe looking back just a little bit, you and I have talked about this. I've mentioned it on the air. I went to the Oscars the year Sally Field won for Best Actress for Places in the Heart. Robert Duvall had won Best Actor the year before, so he presented her award. My sister was married to him, so we were there. Afterward, they sweep you away to this magic elevator. Now, this was the year that Sally Field said, "You like me, you really like me."
Except that is a misquote.
Yes, yes.
Everyone says, "You like me, you really like me." In fact, it's, "You like me right now, you like me," which is a little bit
different,
isn't it?
Right. So, and I, again, perpetrated the misquote. But so we were getting in the elevator and she says to us, "How did I do?" And, you know, I love her. So we're like, "Oh, you did great." And then the door opened again and she went out to this press scrum where within seconds it had turned into these questions about did she just have a terrible moment? And it turned into one of those moments that people mocked. And, you know, this happens with the Oscars. There's things that happen that kind of stay with you,
you know,
that you don't plan on. And can you just reflect on some of those moments? They're all in your, you know, they're in your book.
I mean, I love those moments
when
something a little bit nutty happens. Like, you know, I think of, I don't know, Jennifer Lawrence tripping on the stairs or, you know.
Which she's trying to forget.
Jack Palance doing one-arm push-ups when he won for City Slickers. I also love Roberto Benigni, you know, going across the stairs, climbing over people for Life is Beautiful. But I have been to the Oscars now 5 times, I think, and 2 of those 5 times, something absolutely insane has happened. My first year there was 2017, which was the year of the envelope mix-up with Moonlight and La La Land.
The whole cast of La La Land is called up on the stage as if they'd won. They didn't.
Moonlight, in fact, won. And I was there in the press room, actually, the room you were talking about where they bring the winners after. And I just remember everyone in the press room screamed collectively when that was revealed. And then the 4th time I went in 2022 was the slap.
The slap. Will Smith gets up out of his seat, slaps Chris Rock. Seismic. It is all here in Michael Shulman's book, Oscar Wars, A History of Hollywood in Gold, Sweat, and Tears. I don't think you left one thing out, and it's a great read for film lovers. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Hey, did you miss yesterday's episode? That's fine. I'm not pointing any fingers. But if you want some recipes for snacks inspired by this year's nominated films, you might want to scroll back in the feed to Wednesday's episode and make sure you're subscribed or following Here and Now Anytime so you don't miss anything else. That's it for us today. This show comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Lynn Manigan, Gabrielle Healy, and Emiko Tamagawa. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Peter O'Dowd, Micaela Rodriguez, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto, Caleb Green, and Michaela Varela. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carleen Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the NPR Wine Club. NPR Wine Club members have contributed over $1.5 million to helping create a more informed public. Be 21. Join the charge at nprwineclub.org/podcast. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.